This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. Today is the wrap-up episode. It is Monday, June 25th, 2017, and this is the wrap-up episode again of the 2017 ALA Annual Conference episodes. I hope you all enjoy them so far. If this recording is a little noisy, it is because I am at the Navy Pier being touristy, and I wanted to record the first part of this wrap-up out here. I will talk a little bit more when I get back to my hotel room to record a little more about some sessions that I saw today. But overall, the conference was fantastic. I was able to make a lot of connections with people that I only knew online or that I only heard about professionally, so that was great. And I was able to talk about the work that we do at our library to spread the word about that because the library I work at is fantastic and cool. And was able to answer some questions about things that we're doing and get some ideas from other libraries at the great sessions that we attended throughout the whole conference to bring back and make things even better. So I'm going to throw things over to Steve later tonight in the hotel room to talk more about the specific sessions that I attended today. But overall, conference was great. I loved it. And Chicago is a fantastic town. And I hope to come back again.
Thanks, Steve, from the Navy Pier. I attended a lot of good sessions today. The first one, I went and heard Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, and that was really fun to hear about his process of getting to The Martian in the first place, and then the process of kind of getting it published and all that kind of stuff and into a movie, and then what was he going to do next, and his new book. And I did not get a copy of the advanced copy of his new book because I was not quick enough to get into line, I guess. I stayed around to listen to his whole talk, and I guess that put me too far back in the line. Oh, well. Shrug emoji. So, it was still a great thing, and I look forward to reading the book when it comes out later this year. After that, I went to a session from Booklist called Read and Rave. It was led by Rebecca Vanook, and several other Reader's Advisory librarians talked about some books that they had found advanced reader's copies of at the conference, and things that they wanted to talk up and things that they were looking forward to talking up with their patrons when they got back to the library. So we got to hear about those books, which were fun, and then also kind of a way to book talk them when we get back to their library. I also had a chance to talk to a couple of people today for the podcast, which you'll hear at the end of the episode. That was fun, and trying to fit in some lunch in the middle there too. After lunch and after talking to some people, I went to another session that was really good. It was called Asking for a Friend, Tough Questions and Honest Answers about Organizational Culture. It was a really good session and the room was packed. I was standing outside because I was running a little bit late, so I didn't get a seat. But it was Susan Brown from Chapel Hill, Richard Kong from Skokie, Megan Egbert from Meridian District Library, and Christopher Warren from Auburn Public Library in Alabama. And they were talking about the tough questions, like the session title gives you, about organizational culture and how you can work through them, because sometimes you may feel uncomfortable asking questions about your higher-ups or how your organization is put together. So there was a lot of question and answer sessions for it, trying to bring up those kind of tough questions, and the panel would give you an honest answer to it. And it was nice because they were answering questions in the room. They had people could write questions down on cards and pass them up. They were taking questions off of Twitter. So it was really great, and lots of good things are out there. If you go on Twitter and search the hashtag orgculture, O-R-G culture, you can follow the tweets along with that. Several people were in there live tweeting the session, and so you can get a lot of different perspectives on the same thing. Lots of good information there. So go and check that out, because that was one of the best sessions I've ever been to. And again, this whole conference had a lot of sessions that were some of the best sessions I've ever attended at a conference. So this was a really good conference, and I really had a great time. And I hope I was able to give you a little bit of a taste of the conference through these four episodes that I've done over the last few days. And the conference officially wraps up tomorrow with former Senator Hillary Clinton talking about, I don't know what. Well, I guess we'll find out, because I'm recording this the night before. I won't do an episode tomorrow because that's the only thing really going on with the conference, and I'm sure there'll be some news stories about that you can read up on. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode, and I hope everyone has a great day and gets to attend a conference like this in the future, in the near future, because this was fantastic. And again, I love Chicago. So now you get to hear some interviews I did with Bonnie Tijerina and David Lankus and Jason Griffey.
I'm here with Bonnie Tijerina, and we are going to talk a little bit about a book that she co-edited called Protecting Patron Privacy. Bonnie, can you tell us a little bit about how the book kind of got started in the first place and how you got involved?
Sure. So initially, Bobby Newman, who is my co-editor, submitted a proposal for the book, and then I kind of got added on a little bit later. I think we wanted to have a book that could be sort of very accessible, that covers both some foundations of privacy, sort of the history and sort of foundations of privacy, but then also talks about some real life projects and conversations and debates that are happening right now, and then to do that in sort of a short, concise way. So yeah, we were interested in pulling something like that together.
And you are, I think you said you were originally going to be writing one of the chapters, and then you got involved in the editing as well. What was your initial lead into this book? Like, why did you want to be involved as a writer in the first place, and then even more as an editor later? We'll talk later for another episode that people can look forward to about your job. But what is it that you like that interests you about privacy that you wanted to write a chapter for this or get involved with editing?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit more, like you said, later about what I do. But just to kind of give you an overview, right now I'm a researcher at Data and Society Research Institute. I worked in libraries for over 10 years, and I worked with ALA's Office of Information Technology Policy for about 7 of those years. And so because of that experience, I got really interested in sort of information policy, intellectual freedom, and some of the sort of broader issues that that libraries are dealing with. When I went to Data and Society, the focus of my work there was around looking at specifically privacy. So we're a profession that historically has cared about privacy and our patrons' ability to freely choose and read what they want to read about and learn about. And yet, you know, as we've sort of moved into this more digital world, I don't think we're having sort of enough conversations about what that means and how we sort of migrate that value of privacy from the analog world into the digital world. We are in a much more complex world. We work with a lot more vendors, a lot more third parties, and our patron data moves in a lot of directions that it didn't used to. So I've been interested for years in thinking about how we evolve as libraries while staying true to our values. And specifically at Data and Society, I've been focusing on privacy. So when I knew Bobby was going to be working on this book, I was interested in writing a chapter around sort of the foundations of privacy in libraries, which I did do. I co-authored a chapter with Michael Zimmer on that. But I also was so interested in getting this book out and you know, ensuring that we had a lot of great authors and really valuable chapters that I decided to work with Bobby on co-editing it.
Yeah, and the privacy is something that we kind of have to keep in the forefront because, like you were talking about, we're working with the vendors. The vendors will come and say, well, we can make this so much smoother if we just have all this data. And so they're kind of trying to schmooze it that way of the experience will be so much better for your patrons and this, that, and the other. But there's a line we have to draw, and we don't always remember that. So I'm hoping books like this will help remind people.
Yeah, and specifically around third-party services in libraries, Chapter 5 is a great one. So William Martin, who is the Director of Privacy at New York Public Library. It's a new position. I don't think there's a lot of positions like this in American libraries right now. He is really interested in this aspect, in thinking about how we work with our vendors, whether that's, you know, anywhere from ILS to to even, you know, how we use Google Analytics or how we use other tools from both library vendors, but also kind of larger corporate vendors, technology vendors. And so he kind of helps us in that chapter walk through what that means for libraries, what kind of policies we should be considering, what we should be thinking about in terms of licensing when we license. You know, we have that chance for negotiation when we're licensing something. What should libraries be thinking about when we're doing that kind of stuff?
And then after the introduction, your chapter is the first chapter, the one you co-authored. What is the basic gist of that chapter?
Yeah, so actually, I see chapter 2 and 3, both co-authored by Michael Zimmer, and then I'm a co-author in chapter 2, and then Deborah Caldwell-Stone is in chapter 3. Those I see as kind of the foundational chapters. Those are around sort of looking back historically at the role that privacy has played in libraries. And then Deborah and Michael are looking at sort of the laws, the regulations over time. Where do we sort of put, where's sort of libraries' role, libraries' place in thinking about privacy law and information policies and that kind of thing. So those are kind of some chapters that either for those of us that didn't learn about this in library school or didn't come to libraries with an MLS, you know, those chapters I think are really helpful in just getting some of the basics around why we even care about privacy in libraries.
Yeah, and one of the chapters after that, they talk about security of once you're, because part of it is, it's okay for us to gather some of this information, but we just have to keep it private, because obviously some of our systems requires us to know names, address, phone numbers, whatever, for customers or patrons, so we can send them notices, all this kind of stuff. But we just need to keep it secure. So they talk about that a little bit in a couple of chapters as well.
Yeah. Those the next two parts, the two parts of chapter 4, we kind of put them together because they're looking at data collection, data analysis, data retention, kind of what are our responsibilities. And Matt Beckstrom does it in kind of a more technical way. What are our responsibilities around protecting data? And then Andrew Asher does it more almost like philosophical, really thinking about the ethics of library data, what we actually need to be collecting versus, you know, just because we have the ability to collect, that doesn't necessarily mean we should just collect it and have it sit. What are we collecting, for how long, what's the actual need, especially as we kind of overlay thinking about our values and our ethics on what we're collecting.
And then sort of even tied into that, there's another chapter about various tools that we use that would be the actual tools that you use to collect that information that you're talking about, and why we had to be careful with those kind of tools as well.
Yeah, so chapter 5 and 6, I kind of see those as grouped together because those are about these third-party services. So again, in chapter 5 is William Martin from NYPL talking about interacting with and working with the vendors that you know, we work with in the library. And then Julie Oborney is talking about, you know, when we go off and use Facebook or Twitter to market our our services, and we're interacting, you know, we're using RFID, and we're sort of like these different points of interacting with these sort of third-party tools, she sort of helps kind of get into the nitty-gritty of some best practices for using some of these resources to be thinking about. So when you're using Facebook, how are you, what are the privacy settings you're aware of, and how are you kind of protecting interactions you might have with patrons online? So she kind of goes into more of the best practices on the ground.
Yeah, and especially with things like social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, things like that, they have their own privacy policies, which do not at all really align with what libraries' privacy policies are. I mean, their basically whole business model is around collecting that data and monetizing it. So
yeah, so then it becomes, you know, as long as we're aware of that and we are, aware of how, you know, interacting with those tools, you know, what they're collecting, what that means. I think this book is sort of about awareness. It's not about saying, you know, don't do this, don't do that, you know, go hide under a rock and don't have your library on social media sites and all that. It's more about let's make sure we're aware so that we are making decisions within our organizations. We're weighing pros and cons, and you know, and if we decide that this is better for our services and for our patrons, then you know, I'd rather that we kind of come in with sort of armed with information when making these kind of decisions.
And then the book wraps up with a couple of chapters about training at a couple of different institutions in New York.
Right. So we wanted to also not only talk about kind of best practices with tools, we also wanted to talk about and highlight a few exciting training programs that are going on. And these are training for specifically staff. And some of them also, you know, kind of touch on patrons, but the two we highlighted were specifically for staff training. One comes out of the Brooklyn Public Library. That's a project. It was called the Data Privacy Project. It's a project that was an IMLS-funded project. So Melissa Marone, who's at Brooklyn Public Library, kind of digs into that project. And then the second half of that chapter, that's chapter 7, we talk about some training initiatives and privacy initiatives at sort of a more college academic setting at the CUNY, the City University of New York.
So this is obviously a big thing in libraries. Do you think it's something that we should be doing more patron training on as well?
I do. I think figuring out how to, you know, best incorporate these conversations into digital literacy training and into our interactions with our patrons, I think it's a good idea. One of the things we did with the patron, the data privacy project that Melissa mentions in chapter 7, is we create opportunities to be sort of thinking about different types of patrons that come into libraries, the different concerns and risks they might be dealing with around privacy, and we do that exercise to kind of help us as library staff think about what can I do then? How do I change my internet literacy training courses to address some of these risks and issues that my patrons are potentially experiencing? Or how do I just change my interactions when I'm working front lines, you know, either at sort of an information desk or at the library terminal area? How can I just help patrons know that we can help them if they have questions around privacy, and just let them know that we're an available, trusted resource.
All right, thanks a lot, Bonnie.
All right, thanks.
I am here in the Networking Uncommons with Jason Griffey. Jason, welcome back.
Hey, Steve.
We're going to talk about a couple of things. Mostly, I want to hear about your project you're doing called Measure the Future, which is not a brand new project for you, but it's something new since you were last on the show. So can you tell us briefly what the project is and then what your most recent big update is?
Yeah, absolutely. So Measure the Future is, again, an open source project, just like my previous Library Box project. But Measure the Future is trying to build a system that uses webcams and computer vision to track the movement of people in space so that we can have a better understanding of how patrons use our spaces in libraries, but doing so with kind of a privacy first ethos. So unlike some of the other methods of doing patron tracking, there's certainly lots of experiments going on with that sort of thing. Most of them use either kind of Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or some technological capacity to track people in space. And I just wasn't happy with the kind of privacy threat around that. Mm-hmm. So Measure the Future started a couple of years ago, actually, as a Knight Foundation-funded project. It was one of the Knight Foundation News Challenge for Library winners in 2015, I believe that's right, 2015. And so we've been kind of in background development. We had alpha testing in the fall of last year, and we, you know, fixed all the things that didn't work in alpha, because that's what that's for. And then at this conference, we were able to announce that we're officially going into beta. So we have new hardware, new sensors, new code, new abilities, all of which are now public. They're out on the website. So measurethefuture.net has all of the information, all of, you know, everything, again, open source. There's a build list, all of our hardware, everything is out there for libraries that want to experiment on their own. And we have 7 libraries that we're going to be working with as beta testers, doing installs with them, working on what sort of visualizations they want, working through kind of what kind of questions we can answer with the movement data. And then hopefully, you know, another 6 months or so of development, and we'll be ready to launch more widely to libraries anywhere.
And how do you see, since it's out there open source and that's all great, how do you see your role going forward? Would you like sort of be support in the future? I mean, I know, and developing obviously future versions and things, but is that how you would see yourself, as supporting people who are implementing the open standard stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a couple of options there. There are libraries that have more people than money necessarily, and can implement kind of, you know, the more open source technology. But certainly in my time with libraries, there are libraries that don't have that luxury to just trade, you know, people time for that, and especially for a library that might have a specific need in. You know, we want an answer for a particular question, right? I'm going to, you know, my group will be available on a consulting basis for installing and answering specific questions and that sort of thing. So we hope to be able to find a middle ground between being fully open and letting people do, you know, whatever they want to with the code that we make, but also providing support, providing consulting, providing kind of secondary analysis of the data that's worth, you know, paying for, so that we can keep the project going. It is a very strange position to be in, where I said to someone just the other day, I give everything away and then I hope that people pay me for it, which is kind of a strange business plan. But I mean, my goal is really to give libraries useful tools. The fact that I hope to make it work to pay my mortgage is a side effect of building interesting things more than anything.
Right. Will you be offering like you do with the library box, where it's obviously open as well and people can do what they want, but do you offer for Measure of the Future that you'll put together hardware packages and stuff too?
Yep. Yeah. That's the plan. Yeah. If we'll have a much like library box, if people want to buy sensor kits directly from us, they'll be able to do that. We are part of the beta process so the visualization that we do right now for movement is a fairly simple heat mapping. So the sensor is based on a camera. The camera doesn't take pictures. It looks at the differences in the background and moving pixels, so that what it does is it tracks movement, but not photograph anything. So we don't have issues with identifying people or you know, being able to know who's doing something. But we do get these really illustrative heat maps of your space, your reference area, your reading room, your teen space, your whatever you're interested in kind of seeing how it's being used. So we can tell both kind of what an activity level looks like, how many people on average during specific times, as well as what parts of the space they're using and what parts they aren't. You know, that it's kind of a new way of thinking about understanding space for libraries, and I think there are a number of kind of obvious interesting questions, like why does nobody sit in the corner, right? Like why aren't they going to the left-hand side of our new book display? Like there are some very kind of basic things that that we might be able to answer for libraries. The beta process, I'm really interested in the questions I don't know, right? Like, that's the fun part, is putting these tools into people's hands and then seeing what the community can build out of that. So as we get feedback from people in the beta process, we're going to be adding more and more capability to the visualizations, how we can parse the data, what different kinds of questions we can answer. And that is all going to get built out into a centralized portal that libraries will be able to either implement themselves or, you know, subscribe to effectively. So there's another kind of set of hopefully sustaining revenue somewhere hiding in that as a potential.
Help Jason pay his mortgage.
Yes, yes.
And that fits in, I think, with a lot of what libraries are doing now, of doing having more modular furniture and stuff too, because we're already trying to do that a little bit. You know, let people move the chairs where they want to, and then let it stay there because that's where people want it to be. So this would help fit into all that. So,
yeah, I think the activity in a space is also a little more, I'm also seeing this as a method for better communicating to funders and to, you know, your board, your mayor, your provost, your whoever you're, you know, that you're providing statistics to, whoever you're providing your, gate counts and cert counts to. Those are classic measures of success in a library, but I don't feel like they're particularly useful in modern library usage. They're just not as fully featured as I would like. You know, if I were in a position to have to report numbers to a funder, I would want something that was a little more of a story than just, you know, CERC and, again, gate count, or even, like, number of people that attend a program. And so part of this process, part of building out Measure the Future, is hoping to provide libraries with a data set that allows them to tell a better story about their library to the people who are ultimately responsible for, you know, supporting that library. In obviously hopes of garnering better support. If we can tell a better story with better numbers and better data about how our spaces are busy and active and used, with numbers behind it and with actual, you know, with some visualizations and data underneath those that we can look at over time and show growth and change, and we can iterate on our spaces and make them more interesting, and like all of that, I think garners a much better response from funders and boards than simple counts do. So, you know, my grand plan, you know, is to hope to provide some new groundwork for libraries to be able to tell these stories better and to have better. Better illustrations of what we are actually doing in our communities, because I don't think the simple numbers do that, and I'm hoping to give a little more nuanced ability for us to tell those stories.
And I think you said you have an update on what LibraryBox has been up to recently. Do you have some new development with LibraryBox? I mean, I think it's been a couple of years since you were on the show, so anything over the last couple of years or recently that you want to talk about?
Yeah, we've got kind of two things that are happening right now. One, we in the time since we talked, we've had at least one kind of minor update that added a couple of interesting things, the biggest of which I think was translation and internationalization to LibraryBox. So if you install your own LibraryBox now, it comes with about 14 languages built in, that where the interface is all, you know, pre-translated into. We've got almost all of the Romance languages. We've got, you know, German, all, you know, most of the major languages, but also some more interesting ones. We've got Korean as an example. We've got Kiswahili. We've got a couple of other kind of interesting languages that are less kind of widely spoken, but also interesting for specific communities. So that's probably the biggest update that's already happened since the last time we talked. We've got one more update for some stability coming for the existing hardware that we support, the kind of TP-Link routers that we usually use. The biggest update is that we LibraryBox was chosen as a host program for the Google Summer of Code this summer. So Google Summer of Code is a project where Google selects some open source projects through a selection process that pays computer science students to work for the summer for that open source project. So I've got a situation where I have a computer science student that is doing a specific project for LibraryBox, but being paid by Google, which is awesome and really, really a fun way for me to get some work done. In that, the goal of this summer is actually to port LibraryBox over to the Raspberry Pi 3. So that does a couple of things that are interesting. One is the Raspberry Pi is still fairly inexpensive. It's, you know, under $50 for all the hardware you need. So it meets our you know, cheap hardware. It's also open source, which is great. It's very easy to locate and to get your hands on. It's also more powerful than as a platform than all of the routers that we've used historically, which means that we will have the opportunity now to build out more robust services on the library box. So, for instance, the boxes that we use right now and that people may be familiar with don't index and allow you to search the content because the routers just don't really handle that. They're just not powerful enough. But a Raspberry Pi can, right? We'll be able to put actual ebook servers on them. We can put a Calibre server on there, right? We can put audio rendering on there so that people don't have to have a device that can render whatever audio format is on there. We can do it on server side. So there's a lot of kind of interesting things that the Raspberry Pi will enable then for kind of future growth. So, and that's going to be done again by the end of the summer. We'll have an installer out for that. So that's super exciting. I'm really really looking forward to getting that that part of LibraryBox, another release, another platform, and then an opportunity for it to grow into the future.
That's very awesome. So anything else at the conference that has excited you or anything like that that you want to talk about, and anything you learned or anybody you talked to? Or
gosh, yeah, this is, I mean, conferences are it's so big and so busy, right? I find myself having to go home and look through notes and like look at cards and reconstruct almost, because in the moment it's so tough.
And there's a lot of panels that I was like trying to live tweet to, and it's like, yeah, I don't know if I actually remember what I tweeted. I need to go back and read my own tweets.
Exactly. I mean, there was a great session yesterday morning with Abigail Gobin and Jenica Rogers, where they were talking about privacy in the library. Obviously, that's a topic that's pretty near and dear to my heart. That was really fantastic, and they said, you know, super smart things. I'm sure their notes and everything will be up online. So I encourage people to go find their work, because both of them are really brilliant librarians. And then a lot of my time here at the conference has been, you know, looking in the exhibit hall, finding kind of new and interesting things. I was really pleased to see the expanded maker exhibits here this year. The ALA did a fantastic job of bringing in some really cool vendors that hadn't been here before and projects that hadn't been here before. I think my favorite of those, I have a soft spot for Lulzbot, the 3D printer company. They've been to ALA before, but they had a nice location, and it's a great company and they bake great things.
It's possible I got some 3D printed fidget spinners for my children.
Yes, from them. Yeah, exactly. And then the one that was a new vendor, a new product that had been showcased here that I don't think had been with ALA before is one called Squishy Circuits, mm-hmm. which is just a really cool project that do amazing curricula, fits in so well with the Library Maker space. It teaches kids about circuits and electrical engineering by using conductive Play-Doh. Just if listeners haven't played with Squishy Circuits, go, you know, Google that and take a look at their curricula. They have wonderful educational material. It's designed by educators, and I love their stuff. So
there was a cute booth right next to them, because I was waiting in line to go to Squishy Circuits, and then there was they had like little robots that you can very basically program. It's really basic. It's for kids and everything, but it was really cool because different ways that you touch it and hold it down and just really basic things. And I mean, it wasn't that complicated, but perfect for kids because you can put little silly faces on them and stuff too. So it would really connect well with kids. So
that was Roblox, I think, that was next to
that might have been, yeah.
I think that's who that was. But yeah, so I'm just really thrilled that ALA found it, useful to have that expanded space. There's a lot of VR this year in that area, which was fun to see. I think it's good. It's a good direction. I think it's a useful direction for librarians to get more hands-on-y stuff.
Well, I like that, and I like that it actually was hands-on stuff. It wasn't just, we are vendors, we are showing you our product. It was, sit down here, make a LED badge for yourself where you carve your name into it, and your name lights up, and yeah. I mean, just little stuff like that.
Yeah. It was very hands-on. It was really neat to see that expanded. So that was probably my other big takeaway, was I just really pleased to see how that went and to see how busy they were.
All right, Jason, thank you so much for being on, and hopefully it won't be another 2 years before you're back on again, I think, though.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, I am here with Dr. David Lankus from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science. Welcome back to the show, Dave.
Very good to be here. Thank you.
So you gave the RUSA President's Program, is that
yes.
what that was? Yeah. That was, I talked to several people afterwards, it was all very inspirational, and we loved it, and take a compliment, Dave. Come on.
Thank you. Yes, it was.
Can you talk a little bit about what your kind of basic message of that was? And some of it I know it's tied into the history of the University of South Carolina and some other racial things there. But what was the basic overview of what you were talking about there?
The basic message was that librarians in general, reference librarians in particular, need to be out there working with their all of their communities, every portion of it, whether, you know, economic status, race, religion, to help them learn, and that the focus is on learning, and that ultimately everything we do, from cataloging to libguides to reference to what have you, are learning activities. And so some of this was familiar, but I think that particularly given the political situation that we're in, and ALA is an interesting spot, right? That last midwinter there were marches, and there's a lot of discussion about, are we a liberal or are we a conservative, what have you. And my goal was to say we are a political organization, but that politics is for the good of all, and it involves engagement, getting out and doing something, not just sitting in our buildings and worrying about our neutrality.
Right. We're not talking about, oh, we're a Democratic organization or a Republican organization. That's not what you mean by politics.
No, and that's a good question. I received that a lot. Politics means there's two things that define a community. One is some common known variable, where I live, where I work, where I study, where I teach. And that's what we all focus on. It's sort of the warm, fuzzy feeling about how wonderful it is to be a Chicagoan or et cetera. But the other part that's just as essential is that we have a system for allocating scarce resources, tax dollars, real estate, tuition dollars, what have you. And whenever you talk about divvying up resources, whenever you talk about someone's going to get something and someone's not, that is a political process. It is a power distribution process. And so that's what I mean by political, not ideological, not political party-ish, but that idea that we have to be engaged and understanding to see the work that we do is about how power gets distributed throughout a community, and we need to be very conscious of it. And I think we also have a special obligation to serve and give voice to those that don't normally get a voice or power in that community.
So you brought up something that I was wanting to ask you about anyway, which was empowerment and the fact that a lot of times librarians don't realize they have this power that they can give. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, it's interesting. I ask people out if they're in the empowerment business, and everyone says yes. And I ask, are you in the power business? And they say no. And I'm like, you realize the root of the word is to give power, and you can't give something you don't have. Now, the easiest, simplest way to say it is, if you're going to teach someone to read, you need to know how to read. If you're going to inspire the love of reading, then you need to have that love of reading. But it also comes from, if you're going to lend out books and materials, you know, classic, old school stuff, you need to be able to buy those books and materials, which means someone's given you the authority to do that, the money to do that, and that comes through charter, tax law, or what have you. We've been given power by our communities. It's our job to use it wisely, and that is to give that power, redistribute that power to those in the community that traditionally do not have it.
So you've wrapped up your first year and your new job at South Carolina. How do you feel coming out of that this first year?
I love my job. After I get 1 year, I don't think I can call myself the new guy anymore. Though in South Carolina, you have to, I think, be three generations before you can say, actually, you're not the new guy. But I love it. I love my school. I love my faculty. I love my staff. I love my students. It's a perfect place and the perfect team to be part of, because we want to make a change. It's good scholarship and good action and making it happen. And today we received great news that we get to do it for 7 more years. We've gone through our reaccreditation, so there's breaking news for your podcast. We're reaccredited. So it's been absolutely wonderful to be part of a group that really is thinking about what's the future of library and information science education.
And then I have to finish up with the question I asked for everybody who moves to the South. Have you incorporated y'all into your vocabulary yet?
I've been able to say y'all and all y'all without pausing. But, you know, the first 6 months it's, well, y'all. And now I can get it out. But, you know, there was a New York equivalent to use and use guys. And so now it's y'all and all y'all. So, yeah, I've got it.
Got to get that you plural in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.